From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The cases of two dead journalists were compared and contrasted in this week's column by Margaret Kimberly at blackagendareport.com under her banner Freedom Rider. Yasser Murtaja was a Palestinian journalist when he was murdered by the Israeli military covering the Great Return March in Gaza, with press clearly identifying him in large letters across his chest, near where he suffered a fatal shot from an Israeli sniper. Marie Colvin from the British Sunday Times was killed when the Syrian army bombed the building where she was embedded with the Free Syrian Army, a terrorist group fighting the government inside Syria. In a U.S. court case seeking damages against the Syrian government, it was claimed that the Damascus government tracked Colvin's movements and assassinated her. For more on that, we spoke with Margaret Kimberly about her column and the two cases via Skype Friday.
Yasser Murtaja was killed last week, a Palestinian reporter wearing a vest. It clearly said the word press in giant letters. It couldn't be missed. Yeah. But the IDF shot him anyway, as they have been shooting many people since the Great Return marches began a couple of weeks ago. And he was shot in the abdomen, died some hours later. He's not the first Palestinian journalist to be killed by the IDF. There have been, he's the fifth since the first, I call it the massacre, the people of Gaza that was in 2014. Right. So he's not even the first Palestinian journalist to be killed while doing his job. And, you know, reporters, journalists have been killed in war zones before. It is not unheard of. But these people are targeted, and they're targeted by a government that literally would not exist were it not for U.S. support. Israel is the biggest recipient of U.S. aid, of military aid. They have a powerful lobby. So whatever they do with impunity. So they shoot down people who are peacefully protesting, who are not armed, they, including members of the press. I mean, the atrocities are, this is a very long list. It's an apartheid state. Does what it wants with not just impunity in fact, but with buy-in from the media here. So one would think that members of the press here would defend Yasser Murtaja and his colleagues and defend their right to work without fear of being killed. But the power of that government and its deep alliance with the U.S. government always, but especially with Trump in particular, means that even they are silent about the killing of this man.
You know, you look at every time I see this with Palestinian journalists, I think about actually Iraq when the U.S. bombed the Palestine Hotel in Baghdad, which is where mm-hmm. all the Western journalists were that were covering the U.S. Invasion, and with a lot of the independent journalists were based at the time. Is something about that, just the word Palestine, that draws American bombs and Israeli artillery and whatever. And the photograph, photograph of Yasser Murtaja lying dead on the ground, the words press could almost be seen from outer space. I mean, it's as if targeted the word.
Yeah, but they don't care. I mean, he's actually not the first. I know some years ago, a BBC cameraman, his last name was Miller, as I recall, the same situation, and he was just shot dead. He was working with a correspondent, and an Israeli soldier just shot him dead. And no punishment, no nothing. So he's not the first person clearly identified as press who was killed by the IDF. And the goal is, why do they do this? It's simple. They want to intimidate people. And it's not surprising. I'm sure that the number of people who want to cover Gaza falls who wants to be killed doing their job? So it sends a message. It intimidates people, and also they just don't care. They don't have to care because Israel can, you know, I mean, where to begin? Everything from firing on a U.S. naval vessel in the war in 1967, from attacking the ships, trying to break the Gaza blockade and killing American citizens, running over an American citizen with the tractor. I mean, I could go on the occupation itself and the way it's covered up. And even when it is reported, even when it does appear, anything about Israel appears in the American press, everything is glossed over, and the atrocities committed by Israel are minimized, and the people who do nothing but try to survive and protest their condition, they always find a way to find fault with them, or sometimes just to ignore them. But the end result is always that the U.S. relationship with Israel is not questioned. And that means that the people who are victimized by Israel are demonized or minimized or erased altogether.
You know, I'm looking also at some of the others in Syria that were killed. The Press TV's journalists seem to be very unlucky covering the war in Syria, including having their studios bombed. By quote-unquote insurgents, meaning, you know, the U.S.-backed terrorist groups on the ground. There were a half dozen reporters over the last 6-7 years outside of that incident that have been shot. And it seems odd that, you know, they're just very unlucky compared to, say, CNN reporters. You know, Wolf Blitzer's been, you know, popping in and out of those places since 1990. And his hair's not even mussed.
Well, you know, the problem with Syria is, you know, they're independent journalists, good people who travel there, who go through proper channels, get visas and travel there. Eva Bartlett, Vanessa Beely, and right. Others. But a lot of the reports we see from Syria, the reporters aren't even in Syria. They may be in Lebanon or they may be in Israel. They're not even there. And so we the problem with that is we don't get very good reporting. The people who are independent, they don't have the resources that the network people have. So and so they are, because of their independence, they don't have the platform to reach a broad audience. So we get just this buy-in that the U.S. is right, that Assad is a butcher, that the war was the part of the Arab Spring and people spontaneously rose up to overthrow this tyrant. Not that the United States, working with Saudi Arabia, the other Gulf monarch states, Israel, Turkey. Well, Turkey, you never know what side they're on. But at any rate, we're all in collusion. That's the word of the moment, in collusion to overthrow the Assad government, which is part of a longstanding policy of getting rid of the secular Arab states. And so most people don't even know that. And the terrorists, the jihadist groups, ISIS, al-Nusra, which is an al-Qaeda affiliate, were supported in their efforts to try and destroy Syria and very nearly succeeded. Fortunately, Assad hung on, the Syrian Arab army hung on. Fortunately, Russia finally came in to assist them. Iran came in to assist them, and they've withstood this onslaught. But there's an onslaught of propaganda, pure war propaganda. And the forces of the corporate media, of course, they have the bigger megaphone, so to speak.
Right.
And they get most of the attention. And that's all that most people know. You and I and others we know of alternative independent sites. And we know what to be skeptical of. And most people are just told that Assad gasses his own people. And so that must be true. So that means we must do something. And this is a replay of Iraq 15 years ago, where our government and the corporate media and governments, other NATO countries, all tell us that someone is a danger, that someone is a tyrant, and that something needs to be done. So that means war. Now, of course, Syria, as I just said, is allied with Russia. So if you attack Syria, we are risking war with another nuclear power. And I'm not sure if they've thought this through, if they think Russia will give in, if they think they're going to blink, if they don't care, if they really want a war. It's not clear to me, but this is a very, very dangerous game. And it's being fought not just on the battlefield, not just in the Pentagon and the diplomatic offices, but it's being fought with propaganda. And this week, after the latest story of a chemical weapons attack, and by the way, let me just say this, this footage is faked. There are groups like the White Helmets, who we are told are the great heroes. They are affiliated with Al-Qaeda.
Right.
And they have been routinely faking footage for years now. Even the BBC had a whole series about some sort of chemical weapons attacks, and it was clearly staged and something that never took place.
Yep.
There's no proof that these things happened. And let's remember, about a month ago, the president of France, Macron, said, well, if there's another chemical attack, we will have to take action. And I said, okay, well, how many weeks is it going to be before this chemical attack takes place? And right on cue, there's a report of a chemical attack. I also think that the supposed attack on the Russian spy in Britain, Sergei Skripal, and his daughter, I think that was part of the false flag. It's all very murky, and it's difficult to go on record, but he and his daughter, I believe they were supposed to be killed, but they are still alive. And so now they're being held incommunicado because they could say something inconvenient.
Right. Oops.
Like we don't think the Russian government tried to kill us. And,
right.
And these stories always come at most inopportune times. So we are told that Vladimir Putin, who's getting ready to stage the World Cup, a PR coup for him, who is trying to resolve Syria, that he would all of a sudden decide to kill a spy that the Russians swapped 8 years ago.
Right.
And we're told that Assad, every time he's winning on the battlefield, suddenly he decides to have a chemical weapons attack. It doesn't make any sense. So all these reports are faked. They are lies. And then, of course, we get another propaganda piece here with the lawsuit and the death of a woman named Marie Colvin, an American reporter. She was working for the Sunday Times, a British newspaper, and she was killed in 2012 in Syria. And her family is suing the Syrian government. They filed the suit a couple of years ago. It was in the news this week. What a coincidence. Suing the Syrian government for $300, claiming that the Syrian government tracked her and deliberately assassinated her. And I would just say to everyone that we have to be, at the very least, extremely skeptical of any and all anti-Assad news stories.
Yeah.
We're told there are Syrian defectors. Some of them have aliases. We don't even know if these people exist. We're told there are thousands of documents. Well, I wish that there was someone who had the wherewithal, I do not, to really go through this and get another side
right.
of this story. We do know she was embedded with the so-called Free Syrian Army, which is one of the so-called moderate rebel groups.
Right.
They're terrorists. So she was embedded with the people trying to overthrow Assad. I don't think it's that surprising that she would be that she would die. That there was a missile that hit the house that she and other reporters were in.
Right.
Well, if you're with the Free Syrian Army, the Syrian government, the Syrian Arab Army is going to attack them. And if you're
right.
embedded with them, then you're at risk. She chose to risk going into Syria without a visa. and to be embedded with the Saud's enemies. So it's not surprising that she ended up dead. And she had been an experienced war reporter. She had, in fact, lost an eye covering a war in Sri Lanka. So she made this choice. I'm not happy she's dead, but I don't see any reason for her to be elevated, frankly, the way she has been. And this story is just another example of war propaganda. And someone needs to call this into question. And I made this connection between this man, Yasser Murtaza, who was obviously pressed, who was shot down in broad daylight, in cold blood, by the Israeli army. And he has no legal recourse. His family, they can't sue the Israeli government or the U.S. government. Right. And by the way, foreign governments generally are immune from lawsuits in American courts.
Sovereign immunity, that's right.
Except unless, of course, the state is designated a terrorist state, right, like Syria is, right, and then they can be targeted. And I do wish, frankly, that the Syrian government would respond. Syria and Iran, they're always being sued by someone in the United States. And I think tactically it's an error for them to ignore these lawsuits. I really do wish that they would respond. And we only, so that we don't get this one-sided story of the tyrant who's targeting and assassinating American reporters.
You know, before I get to another comparison, say, of Marie Colvin and Serena Shim, who was an American that was working for Press TV and was killed in Turkey with a cement mixer.
Yes.
Okay, it wasn't very subtle at all. There's an interesting angle to what you just said with the litigation. There was a lawsuit brought by survivors of the attack on the World Trade Center in 2001, and they sued everybody involved the way you're supposed to. Anyone who's alleged to be involved, anyone who might be involved, anyone who's named, you know, or is a conduit, or anything that had anything to do with it. And so they sued Saudi Arabia, of course, because most of the people, the players involved on September 11, 2001, were Saudi nationals. There was some substantive evidence that the state had some role in that as well, and at least foreknowledge, you know, the state of Saudi Arabia. And also, though, because two of the Saudis en route to the United States to commit the act had passed through airports in Iran, they named Iran. Now, when they sued these parties, the Saudis claimed sovereign immunity because they're not on the terrorist list.
Right.
And the Iranians didn't bother to challenge it because they are on the terrorist list. And so they were like, you know, they're going to find against us anyway. Let's not waste any paper defending this. And so what happened was there was I forget how many billions of dollars judgment that was entered in the Southern District of New York against Iran for September 11th, despite the fact that if there was any state actor, it was Saudi Arabia. And if there was any actor in the Middle East not involved, it was Iran.
Yes.
I mean, that's the kind of the circus environment which all these, you know, all this litigation around reporters. So, I mean, we're talking here about Serena Shim, for example, vis-a-vis Colvin. And Serena Shim is in Turkey covering basically infiltration from the Turkish side of the border into Syria. In other words, illegal activity in Turkey that is supporting terrorism in Syria. She's covering that from inside Turkey, and she's an American.
Yes.
And the state of Turkey finds out about it, and they accuse her of being a spy. And almost simultaneously with that, she's driving in a rented car with a driver, and a cement mixer wipes out her car. She survives the crash and then dies of a heart attack after being taken, I guess this is Dick Cheney's house, to an undisclosed location.
Yes, and nobody even knows this story.
In the U.S., she's an American citizen. Imagine if that happened in Damascus, an American citizen.
Oh, you'd never hear the end of it. you would, anything that could be used against, possibly be used against the Syrian government would get very, very wide media play. But that, you know, that, but that always tells you where the lies are, you know.
That's right. That's right.
If the Skripals in England had really been targeted by Russia, and if the government really believed that, they would be in front of the cameras,
right,
talking about how evil Vladimir Putin is and how he tried to kill them. But the fact that they're hiding them tells you that it's, that
right,
it's a lie.
That's right.
And part of a larger campaign, false flags to get people to support the undertaking of causing a wider war. And so Serena Shim gets disappeared, dying under very, very suspicious circumstances. And Marie Colvin dies under some rather ordinary circumstances. She's embedded with people dedicated to overthrowing Assad, and they, right, they attack the place where she is, and she dies.
Right.
But they create this story, and I'm not going to accept it unless some neutral party investigates it, that claiming that the Syrian government deliberately tracked her and killed her. Because, and another, you know, let's just think about this. So this is 2012. Assad is fighting for his country's survival.
Right.
And they are going to take the time, Syrian intelligence and the army and whomever, to decide to kill one reporter.
Right.
I cannot believe it. I can't believe that it's true. But, you know, if you demonize, as we've seen with Putin, if you demonize someone enough, then anything is believed.
Yeah.
Anything. And the worse the charge is, the more easily people accept it. So this this process, the propaganda, the constant vilification is done for a reason. It's effective. Mm. So we're told that Putin tried to poison a former spy that they forgot about 8 years ago. Or we're told that Assad tracked a reporter to kill her, and people believe it.
Yeah. Yeah, look, I mean, they swapped out Skripal for someone who is, in essence, a model, you know, a runway model, Anna Chapman,
yes,
or
yes,
Anya Kuschenko, if you prefer, who was married to a Brit and became a British citizen. She's worked in a variety of fields, worked for the government as a head of a youth council. She was a catwalk model in fashion shows, and she had a TV series that she ran. She goes back after being swapped out. This is not a high priority target. If you're trading this guy for a model, some lower level bureaucrat saying, oh, she's kind of cute, let's get her back here, we can get rid of this schlub. You know, he's right,
yeah,
now we're paying for his lunch, you know, or whatever. Period. So then 8 years later, oh, let's go kill that guy in the middle of all this stuff and create an international incident that sets up World War III. You think?
Right. And yes, and we're always told that, you know, we're always reminded Putin was a spy. He was a spy. He was a spy.
And he's a master chess player, too, of course.
So, yes. So he, better than anybody, would understand the importance of these periodic spy swaps. So he would do something. There aren't going to be any spy swaps after this, not for many years. So he would deliberately destroy the foundation of that espionage system. And
yeah,
I, you know, we can't believe that, either. So in short, we have to be very discerning, and we have to assume, and we're more than likely going to be right, that the anti-Assad information, the anti-Putin information we get is a lie, while something which clearly shows Israel in a negative light is going to be swept away.
Right.
And that's why I was moved to write about Murtaza and,
exactly,
and Colvin this week in Black Agenda Report.
Yeah. You know, another thing, by the way, about what's been going on in Palestine, you know, around in the area that Murtaza was killed. And then this, you know, the activity that's going on there right now. The Israeli Air Force has killed people from the sky. Now,
yes,
if you go back to February of 2011, allegations made by the United States and others at the UN Security Council that Gaddafi, quote unquote, that the Libyan government had been strafing peaceful protesters, quote unquote, which were disproven, by the way. But that was the factual basis for imposing a no-fly zone that became the legal basis for a nine-month bombing, daily bombing campaign against every city in Libya. And yet, that was disproven before the first bomb fell, because they specified at the UN, on so-and-so date, so-and-so time, so-and-so location, you know, two planes strafed here, whatever. The Russians said, Tuesday afternoon, 3 p.m., cert, oh, here's the aerial photography. Nope, nobody there. Next. And each alleged item was disproven, with documentation. Nine-month bombing campaign. Cynthia McKinney told me when she was in Tripoli, it was a 12-hour-a-day deal. You would hear like 80 bombs go off in the city over the course of 12 hours. That went on for 9 months in every city in Libya over the allegations that were false, that people were being shot by the Air Force, people on the ground. Here, it's actually happening on television.
Yes. Yes, it is. It is. But it just this just tells you how the corporate media work hand in hand with governments and to repeat these lies. And it's funny you mentioned Libya, because the no-fly zone resolution at the UN, Russia and China could have vetoed that resolution. Right. But they, for reasons known only to themselves, decided they just abstained, which was the same as voting for it. But I thought I'd bring that up, because we were always told that he, you know, has always been an enemy of America. He was happy to go along with America, yeah. until you can't keep appeasing a tyrant country. Yeah. And our country is the tyrant country. So now, thank goodness, I'm sorry it came to that for him to understand it. But now the United States is facing and this is a good thing. It's a bad thing when there's one superpower and which is yes. not opposed. The United States has to be opposed, but they're not giving up. Even though Assad essentially has won, if they would just pack up and go home, the Syrian people could get right. their country back.
Yeah, and put it back together, because it needs yeah. considerable repair, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, and they've survived, but at a terrible cost. But these people will not let it go, and it's a terrible tragedy, and they are risking a hot war between nuclear powers. But we have to speak out against them and point that out.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, by the way, actually, Putin's a pretty quick study, because Russia and China, after that vote on Libya, pretty quickly started to veto the same resolutions when they presented them for Syria.
Yes, like, they did.
That was
yes,
like three, I think 3 months later was the first one. And because if you read the resolutions, they have nothing to do with authorizing a bombing campaign against the country. It was just a no-fly zone. And if there were actions required to enforce it, that was authorized. That didn't include carpet bombing the country. And so when they saw, oh, that's what they do with this resolution, they said, we have to veto that this time.
Yes, they did. It was a hard lesson for them to learn. Yeah. But
I think you're right. They've been learning, you know, the game. Putin's been upping the game in response to how these people, you know, the Ukraine certainly made them say, well, that's what it was after Ukraine that we heard Russia and China say publicly, we have strategic partnership.
Yes, yes. And they say it quite publicly. And that's and it's a good thing for the world. And it's terrible that people have been lied to so much and confused and are so confused. World peace depends on the United States having a strong opposition. So ironically, you know, so Trump, sends some crazy tweet, you know, saying he's going to attack Russia, and, you know, a half hour later says, no, let's be friends with Russia. I think there was constant communication. And yeah. I think Putin drew a red line and said, if you do anything in Syria, we're going to strike back. Yeah. And while that is at the frightening on the one hand, it's heartening on the other hand, because it means the United States is being kept in check and can't just do what it wants to do without paying repercussions.
Margaret Kimberly has a weekly column at blackagendareport.com under the banner Freedom Rider. We've been discussing her column this past week. Yasser Murtaza and Marie Colvin. Thank you very much, Margaret.
Thank you, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.